Okay, thank you very much for returning so promptly from the teas and coffees and biscuits. I'm Glenn Rangwala. I'm a lecturer in politics at Cambridge University, and it's my pleasure to introduce this next session to you. Just one piece of housekeeping before we begin. I've been told by a few people that these little name badges that we have for all conference participants are very useful, so we don't need to keep introducing ourselves to each other, often to the same person repeatedly. I'd be very grateful if you could collect, if you haven't done already, after this session is over. They're all outside on the desk at the bottom of the stairs. This next theme has been broken up into two sessions because of its popularity. We've got a theme on Gertrude Bell and the foundation of Iraq, which the next six speakers will be addressing. And it falls to me to just say a couple of words to introduce this theme. The narrative we all know, or we all think we know, is of Bell's significance for the foundation of the Iraqi state, the modern Iraqi state. Bell's hagiographers and supporters, of whom there are many, will credit her with a list of impressive achievements in the foundation of the Iraqi state, from its borders and its flag, to its structure of government, to its character of its monarchy, to its educational system, to its language, its dialect, to its heritage, to the very character of what it means to be a modern Iraqi. These are attributes that are given to Bell's achievements within Iraq in that period from the First World War through to her death in 1926. These are achievements that she, I think, herself upheld. She wrote in letters in her diary of her own significance for Iraq in a letter to her stepmother, Florence, in December 1918. She wrote that she felt, quote, as the creator, capital C, in the middle of the week. That's in the Abrahamic religions, a reference to the creation of the universe. She wrote, he too must have wondered what it was going to be like, as I do, comparing herself in the creation of the Iraqi state to God in the creation of the universe. She wrote later on, a much more famous quote, she described her role as that of making kings and inventing kingdoms. Those are both quotes in Leora Lukic's book, her biography of Bell. In that way, at least, she's presenting herself as being central to the process of the creation of the Iraqi state, and her supporters will attribute her collectively or individually, usually individually, with these achievements. But of course, this may be something that we could see critically. This is something that it falls within the character of the nature of British officials to see in their role in empire. They attribute themselves an agency which they deprive to locals. And so one of the themes that these next six speakers will be addressing is the accuracy of the claim that Bell was central to the foundation of the modern Iraqi state as we see it today. But secondly, that element of self-belief, what sort of baggage did British officials bring with them? Not just Bell, but Cox and Wilson, the Lawrence and Club. What sort of beliefs did they bring with them? How were those beliefs transformed, if at all, in their experience in the country? How were those beliefs transferred or failed to be transferred to the population over whom they exercised power? What do those self-beliefs or self-characterizations say about this time in modern British as well as Iraqi political life? And third, a third theme, which I hope many of our speakers will be addressing, is to make some sort of evaluation of their role. Not just a sort of abstract ethical evaluation, empire right or wrong, but some sense of the legacy with which Bell and others have left for the Iraqi state. There are those, of course, who see a legacy that, in the words of the Times obituary for her on her untimely death, spoke of her as Iraq's lost guide, the person who could have taken Iraq through the turbulence of the post-independence era, but who is lost to Iraq and without whom, as it were, Iraq would struggle as a country to develop economically, socially, politically. Someone who's left a legacy that was cut short, but significant for understanding how Iraq could have been so much in ascending power in the Middle East. And there are those who take the opposite perspective, that intentionally or not, Bell and other colonial officials created a set of structures, both imposing a set of governmental structures and a set of beliefs that were peculiarly ill-suited to the population who came to be the first citizens of Iraq. So those are some of the themes that our speakers will be addressing over these next two sessions. It gives me great pleasure to mention them to you in this first panel. I'll introduce them in reverse order. I'm not going to go over their institutional affiliations because you've got that already in the programme, but just a few personal reflections. Our third speaker in this panel will be on my right, your left, to me, Fouad Kadem. When Fouad first contacted us in respect of this conference, he was still a PhD student at the University of Exeter, having graduated from Baghdad in political science. He's since obtained his doctorate 2 weeks ago, I believe, and he's based now at the Centre of Academic Shia Studies, a lively and a hub of Middle Eastern studies in northwest London, which deals with issues that I think are becoming increasingly central to how many people in this country, at least, now view the Middle East through these sectarian prisons. And I think the centre has become one of those core, vibrant hubs for helping us understand what sectarianism does and does not mean for the Middle East, for the Arab world, for Muslims across the globe in this modern, troubled era. Our second speaker is Moed Hanoush, who has been on my left, who has been a consistent friend of BC over many years. Although he's a scientist by training, he has a wealth of historical knowledge that is enviable for any of us who try and do this thing professionally. He's been a consistent contributor to debates within BC over many years about Iraq's history, especially the history around the First World War. And we were only too delighted to receive his proposal to present a paper at the conference here today. Our first speaker, though, is Toby Dodge, now a reader at the LSE, whose book, Inventing Iraq, from 2003, a decade old now, was a landmark in modern Iraqi studies internationally. It's still a book that all my students who learn about the history of modern Iraq treat as their Bible. It's one of those books that I always struggle to get my students to think outside of, but has consistently failed to get them to see how else one could think about Iraq at this period. It's become a landmark study of modern Iraq. Although Toby's more recent work has been on contemporary Iraq, it's a pleasure to be able to introduce him today, going back to that period. Going back to the period of the 1910s and 20s, to give a presentation on this theme. So could I invite him to the desk?
Right, thank you very much, and thanks, Clay, for that wonderful introduction, and I apologise to your students for having to have read my book. I want to do four things today. Well, first I want to thank Glenn for chairing, Charles Tripp, and Jean Porter, Makaira, and the organising committee of the conference for asking me to take part. I've got a 9,000-word paper, which I was tempted to subject you to, but I know Glenn's going to be a very harsh chair, so I've got a 20-minute presentation, so I'm just going to telegraph a few things out. And these are the four things I want to do. Firstly, I want to introduce the four people, including Bell, obviously, around which I want to hang my presentation, as the representatives of the British colonial administration in Iraq. And they represent different aspects, both military and civilian, of the British presence in Iraq, 1920 to 1932. And they want to go on to justify their influence, not only as the key colonial figures who set about trying to create the Iraqi state, but also, in at least three cases, I think the leading Orientalists of their generation, who through their writings sold Iraq and the British colonial presence in the Middle East back to a wider population in Britain. Thirdly, and I think that the intellectual hub of the paper is to examine the intellectual discourses that shape their understanding of Iraq, especially state-society relations, and the main ideational influence I think dominated how they interacted with Iraq is what I've called Oriental despotism. And finally, I want to examine the legacy of that kind of ideational understanding of Iraq and indeed their actions on the state built under the British mandate. Now, firstly, as you see down on one side, the four themes, but on the other side, two pictures. The first is Gertrude Bell and King Faisal picnicking in the desert outside Baghdad. And I think that's the way some of Bell's great promoters and indeed some of the people removed from the colonial imposition of the state in Iraq would like us to remember the British presence in Iraq. But I thought I'd juxtapose that against a Royal Air Force aeroplane flying across the Iraqi desert. And this is an attempt, hopefully, to dispel any sepia-tainted nostalgia for this period of British colonial history. British dominion over Iraq, although supposedly regulated and justified under a League of Nations mandate, was in fact violently imposed from the air on the mass of ordinary rural Iraqis who had little choice but to accept it. And this was imposed through a new colonial tool of control, air policing. This was, to put it bluntly, the unleashing of aeroplane-delivered terror on the populations of southern and northern Iraq, who simply refused to recognize the authority of Baghdad or pay taxes towards it. So as we run through that, let us be in no doubt that Bell and her colleagues were involved in the violent imposition of colonial rule on an unwilling population in Iraq. Now let me introduce the four key characters in the talk I'm just about to give, who I would argue were the central British state builders. The first, of course, is Gertrude Bell sitting next to T. Lawrence. She arrived in Basra in 1916 and served as the High Commissioner's Oriental Secretary until her death in 1926. Now, in this post, I think, as I was saying in a question in the earlier panel, her influence varied greatly. I think she was clearly a key advisor to Sir Percy Cox, deeply loathed by the acting High Commissioner, A.T. Wilson, and then somewhat in between by the High Commissioner, Sir Percy Cox. She certainly prepared her intelligence reports, suggested who they meet, and generally advised on all aspects of Iraqi politics. She was certainly Percy Cox's gatekeeper to Iraq. We then move on to Sir Henry Dobbs. I just found this picture that's available in the National Portrait Gallery, and I may well, with my partner's permission, buy it and hang it in my new flat. Dobbs was first posted, Dobbs was first posted to Iraq from India in 1915 and served there as Revenue Secretary until October 1916, where he then returned to New Delhi. The taxation and legal regulations that he drafted in that year, I would argue, shaped the state's interaction, especially in land tenure and legal matters with Iraqi society. He then arrived back in Baghdad in 1923 to become Iraq's longest-serving British High Commissioner, only leaving in 1929. If there are British fingerprints on the Iraqi state, they are Sir Henry Dobbs's. He's the key builder of the Mandate State. Thirdly, is John Bagot Glubb, who was posted to Iraq in 1920 and served as a special service officer amongst the rural population of southern Iraq. It was Glubb, much more fondly remembered for his time in Jordan after 1930 as Glubb Pasha. But let us not forget, it was Glubb who played the key role in perfecting air policing, riding on his horse through the rural villages of southern Iraq, jovially meeting what he perceived to be the tribal sheikhs, delivering tax demands for them to give up part of their rural agricultural produce. And when they refused, bombing them from the air using maps that he drafted, phosphorus shells on reed-built villages. You can imagine the terror this unleashed in the rural population who had yet to see much of aeroplanes, let alone the destruction they could bring. And finally, Stephen Hemsley Longrigg, which very annoyingly I couldn't find a picture of. Longrigg's direct experience of Britain's role in Iraq was probably the greatest of any non-Iraqi who served there. First into the country as a soldier of the British Expeditionary Force in 1914. In 1918, he transferred to the civil authority running Iraq after serving in Kirkuk, and then in Diwaniya, he was appointed a political officer responsible for Hilla province. And then he was promoted in 1926 to the post of Revenue Secretary to the Ministry of Finance, basically overseeing until 1931 the extraction of tax from Iraqi society. Now, if we look at their influence, I think Longrig and Glubb especially, and to a lesser extent Bell with the publication of her letters, shaped how the British population understood Iraq and the British colonial interaction after the First World War with the wider Middle East. Glubb's books deal somewhat tangentially with Iraq, include The Story of the Arab Legion, Arabian Adventures, 10 Years of Joyful Service, and The Changing Scenes of Life, and Autobiography. Bell, as we know, as was mentioned earlier, wrote The Desert and the Stone about pre-British colonial, the Middle East under the Ottoman Empire. And then, more intriguingly, just up there, Le Green republished after the invasion, after 1991. She wrote the first official description of the Iraqi population published for the benefit of the occupying powers, the Arabs of Mesopotamia, a more deeply Orientalist, if not racist, book you will be hard-pressed to find. And finally, Stephen Longrig's book, 4 Centuries of Modern Iraq, and an updated and published by Chatham House, Iraq from 1900 to 1950. Now, these monographs bear all the authenticity and legitimacy, in Longrig's case especially, of a serving colonial official. Imagine him by lantern light at night coming home from his work, drafting books for publication in London, explaining, justifying the British civilizing mission, the mandate of building a mandated state in Iraq. They explained what the British were doing in Iraq in a very imperial, orientalist, and I would argue derogatory way. And so with these, Bell, Longrig and Glubb, I think, were amongst not only the first rank of orientalists, but the popular proselytizers for the colonial mission in the Middle East after the First World War, and let us not forget, a deeply unpopular mission. The Britain's presence in Iraq was hotly debated through the 20s. A central argument in a very contested election campaign, with a bag and baggage campaign led by the Daily Mail, if my memory serves me right, demanded the withdrawal of Iraq, withdrawal of British forces from Iraq as an overextension in imperial hubris. So let's now jump on to what I want to argue today. That there was a sense, I think, in the historiography of Bell that she was somehow an intrepid individualist, along with Glubb, Longrig and Dobbs, moving out into this great unknown. What I want to argue here is that their understanding of Iraq, of the Ottoman Empire, of the East and Arabs more generally, sprang directly from the socialization they gained within their own society, Britain, at school, at university, in British society. Now, a good place of departure would, of course, be Edward Said's landmark book, Orientalism. Now, what he is arguing is that far from these imperial colonial civil servants being autonomous adventurers moving out into the Middle East, they were clearly a central part of a colonial project, but more importantly, their room for agency, for individual action, was constrained by the social discourses through which they and the rest of Britain, the rest of the Western world, for Said, understood the Middle East. Now, I want to step away from a somewhat mechanicalistic application of Said to say that he overstated the simplicity of the narrative, negative projections of the Orient from Britain onto the Middle East. I'd say there were two broad categories, and this is the central point of my argument. One judged the Middle East, and indeed the Arabs of the Middle East, as simply immature, that they were on a unilinear path to development, and what British role was to do was to pick them up and push them further along it. So we're justifying colonialism by saying they're backward, they're immature, we have a mandate, a role to bring them forward to development and modernity. The second is much, much more negative and is pathological. That sections of the Middle East, sections of the East, of the developing world, had stepped off this unilinear path to development, couldn't be brought along it, and were negative and contaminated. And I think in this distinction, we see the distinction between how British colonialism understood the Arab population of the Middle East, especially after the so-called Arab Revolt led by T.E. Lawrence against the Ottoman Empire, and the empire itself. The Ottoman Empire itself was described in classic Oriental despotism terms, that basically it was a corrupt, repressive institution, that it was extracting resources from the wider Arab population and bringing in its way corruption and repression. So that was the pathological aspect of Orientalism in the Middle East. On the other side, you had the immature, but hard-working, possibly redeemable Arabs who would recognize their full potential through British imperial guidance. And I think when we come through to the Middle East, where we see this juxtaposition between repressed societies and despotic states reproduced from Montesquieu onwards, through those working in the 18th and 19th century reproducing discussions of the East and the Ottoman Empire. We can see it in Hegel, Weber, Marx, both Mill, James and John Stuart. And of course, what it represents is very little to do with the reality of the Middle East itself, but the insecurities of Britain at any given moment. And I wonder if we speculate about today, American and British society, and what they seek to cure the Middle East of through the application of coercion, what that says about our own societies, not necessarily those that are being targeted. And I think when we come to the 1920s and look at the notion of Oriental despotism carried out into the Middle East, what we find is a series of British civil servants deeply concerned about their own society, rapidly urbanizing, rapidly democratizing, with the mass majority of the population now having a say in the running of the British state. More land changed hands after the First World War, i.e. the decline of a rural aristocracy in Britain, than at any time since the dissolution of the monasteries. So we have a British society deeply uneasy about itself, projecting that unease onto Iraqi society. Now, in Iraqi society, we can see with Bell, with Dobbs, with Glubb, with Longrigg, these fears being projected onto Iraqi society, and I would argue, shaping the way the Iraqi state was created. For Gertrude Bell, the Ottoman Empire was, quote, a land of make-believe. The empire's self-image for Bell propounded in administrative detail and through a multitude of edicts and laws that everything had, that the Ottoman Empire had every trapping of sovereignty. But Bell, she would argue, knew better, that the government officials spread out across the Arab provinces of the empire had little or no power to regulate Arab society. That power was anchored deeply within rural society and held by village headmen, tribal sheikhs, or the local sayyids. The empire, as it moved through the Arab provinces, was spreading corruption, a kind of bastardized form of modernity and urbanization. So what, under this juxtaposition, as the British travelled through Iraq, they were interacting with a demobilized, possibly immature, but grateful Arab population, and seeking to limit, to turn over, to reform the dead hand of Ottoman power. So this juxtaposition then runs through all of the four individuals that I'm looking at today and in greater depth in the paper. On one side, and you see this clearly in Bell's letters, you have the noble sheikh, the tribes people of rural Iraq, untouched by modernity and honest. There's a wonderful section in one of her letters where she's studying the adjudication of judicial disputes in rural Iraq. So we don't need a judge. We don't even need a policeman. All these people need to do is swear on the Quran and they'll tell us the truth and we can adjudicate between them. And juxtaposed against that is what's been labelled in Oriental records, in letters, in repeatedly in the archives down at the Kew, and indeed in the Iraqi archives now held in New Delhi, is the Befezd Effendi. The classic example of Ottoman contamination. Civil servants trained under the Ottoman Empire, simply interested in aping European fashion and modernity, extracting resources from the Iraqi population and indeed the British state. Now, as Peter Slugler has very powerfully pointed out, not only in his own work, but in the paper he's just given, this caricature is simply empirically unsustainable, but it runs through all of the work and the archives of the four people that I've identified. So Henry Dobbs, for example, when he's describing Iraqi society, claims that the countrymen, including the inhabitants of the villages, are almost all tribal. Unlike the cultivators of Egypt or India or even Persia, in this respect, I doubt whether the condition of any other country, even of Afghanistan's, resembles those of Iraq. What Dobbs is setting up is an almost ideal type of a society unspoilt by capitalism and modernity. All you need to do is remove the Ottoman Empire to let loose noble savage in his honesty. And you see this in Dobbs' drafting of the tribal and criminal civil disputes regulations, drawn up by himself in February 1916, sanctioned by the British occupying forces in July 1918, and introduced into Iraqi law in 1924. This is Oriental despotism personified. It separates overtly and clearly rural society from urban society. Urban society is governed by Iraqi civil law, originally based under Ottoman codes, which are then redrafted as the state gets more powerful and more demanding of its society. Those deemed to be tribal, are then treated completely separately under a set of codes, ironically first drafted in the northwest frontier of India, and treated collectively as though they didn't need the state to impact upon them. Now I'll jump, because my chair has taken the legs from under me, I'll jump to the conclusions of what this effect of this dichotomous approach to Iraqi society delivered. So the British civil administration from 1920 to 1932 imposed order and regulation on the Iraqi population after the army's vision around this dichotomous view. They set up a different electoral system, guaranteed to swell the ranks of parliamentarians with tribal representatives from rural areas. They then set up a legal system that treated Iraqi urban dwellers radically different from so-called tribal rural dwellers, and gave the authority to oversee rural areas to tribal sheikhs in Iraq. The legal system, the taxation system, the land tenure system was all organized to keep this dichotomous relationship and to empower rural representatives, the so-called tribal sheikhs of Iraq. What were the outcomes of this? Clearly, that dichotomy was completely empirically unsustainable. Iraq was rapidly urbanizing. Mosul, Baghdad, and Basra were swelling with people fresh from the countryside looking for the benefits that urbanization, modernity, and the state could give them. Yet these people, as soon as they came into cities, were treated by the British as unrepresentative of Iraq and treated with contempt. The true Iraq was to be found in rural societies, and those rural societies were to be given the whip hand, the balance of power against an urban-based elite, civil service, and lawyers. And so the electoral system, the taxation system, the legal system, was meant to empower tribal sheikhs and set them almost like de Tocqueville's civil society, looking over the urban state to guard against the swelling of power. The legacy of that from 1932 to 1958 is a massive empowerment of freshly created by the British land tenure and taxation system, freshly created landlords who are meant to be rural sheikhs representative of their population, but are actually greatly ironic or despotic in their treatment of the rural population, who extracted wealth from that population and lived extremely wealthy lives. That system, a massive
massive imbalance of wealth, money staying in the hands of tribal sheikhs, not being extracted by the state or the rural population, led directly to the coup of 1958 and the instability that has dogged Iraq ever since. So if we pick up Iraq like a china plate and turn it over, what we see is made in Britain and made very poorly in Britain. Thank you very much.
Secret Tapers, Gertrude Bell and her role at the Paris Peace Conference and the Cairo Conference. From an official report of the Paris Peace Conference, first statement, the country would be very badly governed. Second statement, why should it not be badly governed? Third statement, it ought to be badly governed. With these words, Gertrude Bell begins her report on the political situation in Arabia following her attendance at the Paris Peace Conference. The period spanning the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 and the Cairo Conference in 1921 is of importance to the history of British colonial occupation of Mesopotamia. Ms. Bell's participation in these two conferences and her subsequent involvement and contributions were influential in the political processes which led to the creation of monarchy in Iraq, the Paris Peace Conference. No sooner than the victorious Allies succeeded in liberating nations and lands from the yoke of defunct empires, the question of whether to give these new nations the right of self-determination had arisen. As plans and schemes were being devised by the Allies concerning the spoils of war, two main problems arose. Firstly, the administration of the occupied territories. Secondly, the adherence to the principles of self-determination according to U.S. President Woodrow Wilson's 14-point speech in 1918 concerning colonial claims and sovereignty. In Mesopotamia, the questions of self-determination were as vague to the decision-makers in London as they were in Baghdad. When A.T. Wilson, the acting commissioner for Mesopotamia, wrote to London regarding the inconsistencies on declared policies for the future of Mesopotamia, he was referred to a previous directive from London demanding, quote, no large or controversial administrative questions to be raised, end quote. On this, he commented, quote, I presumed, perhaps rightly, that if the oracles, these are London's oracles, were dumb, it was because their doubts were even greater than ours, end quote. In January 1919, politicians were converging on Paris for the peace conference. For six extraordinary months, the city was effectively the center of the world's government, as peacemakers wanted bankrupt empires and created new countries and established a world order, presumably, based on democracy and reason. The future of Arabia, and specifically Mesopotamia, was a contentious issue. For the politicians, including Ms. Bell, several events that had occurred during the 4 year of war had influenced their decision. Firstly, the Hussein-Macmahon correspondence, 1915-1916. Secondly, the Sykes-Picot Agreement in 1916. Thirdly, General Mott Baghdad Proclamation 1917. Fourth, the Balfour Declaration 1918. And lastly, President Wilson's 14-point speech in 1918. Almost all of the above promised a form of self-determination, a promise which the colonial powers seemed to have no intentions of keeping. By the end of 1918, Ms. Bell was immersed in the preparation of reports for the Paris Peace Conference. The debates in London from 1918 until the convening of the conference remained contradictory and inconclusive. A.T. Wilson suggested in November 1919 1918, quote, that Iraq should be ruled by a British High Commissioner with Arab ministers backed by British advisors, end quote, went as far as His Majesty's government directed them not to make any announcement on such a proposal until Miss Bell's arrival in Paris. Miss Bell arrived in Paris on March 7, 1919. Any thoughts of finding a solution for Mesopotamia or indeed Arabia must have been self-deluding. The attitude of Britain and France towards the Middle East can be summed up in an encounter between Arnold Toynbee and an advisor to the British delegation at the peace conference and David Lloyd George, in which he, i.e. Toynbee, had to deliver some papers to the British Prime Minister. David Lloyd George forgot Toynbee's presence and began thinking out loud, quote, Mesopotamia, yes, oil, irrigation, we must have Mesopotamia. Palestine, yes, Holy Land, Zionism, we must have Palestine. Syria, what is there in Syria? Let the French have it. Quote, Miss Bell's and later E.T. Wilson's arrival wasn't received as they had hoped. They were designated members of the British delegation as part of the India office. And this is to confirm the confusion over their roles. Montagu, the Secretary of the India office, wrote to Balfour, the Foreign Secretary, quote, we have now collected in Paris Miss Bell and Colonel Wilson. They are responsible to me. I can give them no information of what is going on. And this is the letter from Montagu to Balfour. However, Miss Bell wasn't deterred. She plunged into the social and diplomatic whirlwind that also enveloped Prince Faisal and T.D. Lawrence. She pressed her views and all who would listen. Earlier, Sir Arthur Hirzel of the India Office had said, quote, what we want is some administration with Arab institutions which we can safely leave while pulling the strings ourselves. End quote. This was more easily said than done. There was a new spirit stirring in the Middle East. Stirring in the Arab world. Wilson's Oriental Secretary realized this, even if he did not. Gertrude Bell was the only woman to play a key role in the peace settlement in her own right. She had maintained her beliefs that Mesopotamia's future must be part of Arabia's future. As far back as April 1916, she wrote, quote, politically, too, we rushed into the business with our usual disregard for a comprehensive political scheme. We treated Mesopotamia as if it were an isolated unit instead of it being part of Arabia, and is yet always and always one of the same indivisible bloc. End quote. To stress this point, while in Paris she wrote a personal letter to Balfour on hers and Lawrence's behalf, emphasizing the importance of treating Mesopotamia and Syria situation as one. This is the letter. It's a beautifully written letter with her best handwriting. Dear Mr. Balfour, I'll read it. Will you please forgive me for sending you a memorandum? Mercifully short, because we all know better if you have her letters, pages and pages and pages, which represents the views of Colonel Wilson and myself on the Arab settlement and exclusively concerned with my, and I really like this, it's not part of the quote, with my own people, Arab of Mesopotamia. While Colonel Lawrence has Syria most in his mind. But both of us realize that the paths make one whole and we must think not in provinces but in terms of the Arab race. Yours sincerely, Gertrude Bell. Just to show you an example of her other handwriting, this is a letter that she wrote to Lawrence on her arrival in Basra in 1916. I think it's the first letter she ever wrote from Basra. But you can tell the difference. The reason I can actually read the handwriting, because my handwriting is so bad, I can actually read this one. On March the 7th in Paris, she wrote, quote, our Eastern affairs are complex beyond all words, and until I came, there was no one to put the Mesopotamian side of the question at first hand. I'm lunching tomorrow with Mr. Balfour, who I fancy really doesn't care. Ultimately, I hope to catch David Lloyd George by the coattails if I could manage to do so. I believe I can enlist his sympathies. They all have urged me to stay, and I think for the moment that's my business. End quote. She also wrote something which is unkind to the Americans. Quote, I can't think how things are going to develop, but I'm deep in propaganda. But for the moment, there is nothing to be done except educate the Americans. Quote. Lawrence and Faisal suffered a much worse introduction to the conference. Faisal's aim was to convey the promise that was made to his father, Sharif Hussein, for an independent Arab kingdom. They attended formal meetings of the conference on February the 6th and the 9th, where Faisal presented his case for Arab independence. These efforts were in vain. Faisal was to return to Syria without any promises. Just for the Iraqis sitting here, this is a lovely picture of Nurisai when he was young. And there he is again.
Unless he was young.
He was 33, but. These efforts were in vain. Faisal was to return to Syria without. Faisal was returned to Syria without any promises of hope for a favorable response from the allies or question of self-determination. Earlier, Mustafa had a meeting in Paris with Faisal and told him, quote, there was no power on earth which would make France relinquish the Syrian mandate, end quote. Faisal had received this opinion with dismay. Mustafa had gone straight to Balfour and begged him to convey the message to Faisal. Balfour called his assistant, Ian Malcolm, and asked him to remind him to acquaint David Lloyd George on this. Ian, producing a quizzed notebook, made the desired entry. Miss Ben noted in a diary, quote, Ian's notebook was the epitome of old cul-de-sac, end quote. Miss Ben left Paris in 1919. On March the 8th, 1920, the General Syria Council passed a resolution declaring Syria's independence with Faisal as its king. The Allies, as a consequence, met in San Remo to declare the mandates for Iraq and Syria, which was made public on May the 25th, 1920. The aftermath of the mandate affected and transformed the geopolitical situation of Northern Arabia. In the eyes of the Arabs, San Remo's decision went nothing short of betrayal. Syria and Iraq revolted. The French occupied Syria in 1920, and with it the subsequent expulsion of Faisal on July 28, 1920. In Iraq, the causes for the uprising were blamed on A.T. Wilson's mishandling of the country's administration, despite his claiming otherwise. This led to his replacement by Sir Percy Balcomford on October 4, 1920, who immediately started the process of instituting an Iraqi National Council. Events in Iraq had begun to establish a kind of self-determination with the Britain interest protected by a mandate and later by treaties. These interests in the future state of Iraq subsequently led to the conference in Cairo in 1921. The Cairo Conference. During November 1920, Ms. Bell was highly active in the process of creating the Provincial Council of Iraq. On November 1st, 1920, she wrote, quote, I set off feeling as if I carried the future of Iraq in my hands. Long live to the Arab government. Give them responsibility and make them settle their own affairs, and they will do it every time, 1,000 times better than we can. End quote. The revolt in Mesopotamia and the cost and loss of the British lives were having its repercussion on decision makers in Britain. Orders were given to Sir Percy Cope to start the process of evacuating troops from Mosul and Baghdad to the Basra line as one option of reducing costs. One workable option was Faisal and the establishment of a kingdom. Faisal's option would replicate the promise to give independence to an Arab state, albeit Iraq, only Iraq. It would cut the cost of the army by asking Faisal to raise an Arab national army to protect itself, but with a proviso of British control through the placement of the mandate with treaty. The British cabinet agreed on a decision for Faisal on this meeting on December 31st, 1920. Meanwhile, the control of Iraq's destiny had been transferred to the colonial office, of which Mr. Winston Churchill now had assumed the portfolio, who then decided to summon the conference in Cairo early in March 1921. Britain needed a reduction in its army without jeopardizing the mandate of Iraq. Churchill described the main purpose of the conference, quote, to maintain firm control over Iraq as cheaply as possible, unquote. The Cairo conference commenced on March 12, 1921. Miss Bell was the only woman participant. Churchill formed two committees to deal with the agenda, a military financial committee plus a political committee. Miss Bell was on the political. The first political committee meeting was held on March 12, 1921. Her contribution to the discussions during these committee meetings were well documented by Churchill's report to the Prime Minister. Her views on the Sharifian policy and the political situation in Iraq would have been a major influence on the proceedings. When asked about Mosul, she replied, quote, she considered that Mosul should undoubtedly be included in Iraq. End quote. The conference decided that the political conditions involved the necessity for a Sharifian ruler to be selected for Mesopotamia and that the most suitable ruler was Emir Faisal. The conference ended with Churchill's communicating the finding to the Prime Minister in two telegrams in which he wrote, quote, I have no doubt personally Faisal offers far away best chance of saving this money, end quote. During the following months, until the arrival of Faisal in Iraq on June 23, 1921, Miss Bell was preparing the country for its future state as a kingdom. On July 11, 1921, the Council of Ministers passed a resolution declaring King Faisal King of Iraq. A referendum was held, producing 96% majority in favor of Faisal, and on August 23, 1921, he was crowned in Baghdad. Miss Bell stayed in Iraq as a political advisor and later as honorary director of Integrities until her sudden death in July 12, 1926. Conclusion. Miss Bell's contribution, just before I go to the conclusion, the number of these people participants were 39 plus Gertrude Bell, I think they were 40. It was jokingly said that Churchill commented, or somebody commented, that this was the 40 Phillips of Baghdad. Whether Churchill said it or didn't say it, I don't know. But that's the general sort of consensus that it was said during the conference. Right, let's be serious. Conclusion. Miss Bell's contribution to the future of Mesopotamia through her participation in the two conferences, plus her efforts and energy, especially to implement the resolutions of the latter, were significant and certainly valued by the decision makers in Britain. The most poignant acknowledgement of her efforts can be seen in a reply of David Lloyd George's telegram to Churchill on March 16, 1921. When the latter was asking for approval to the Cairo Conference resolution, His Majesty's government Prime Minister David Lloyd George answered to Winston Churchill, quote, we think it essential, therefore, that real initiative in any demand for Faisal should come from Mesopotamia. Sir Percy Cox and Miss Gertrude Bell would no doubt advise you to whether this initiative would be forthcoming, end quote. For His Majesty's government Prime Minister to ask Winston Churchill to seek advice from Miss Bell on the future of Iraq is a remarkable tribute to a remarkable lady. Thank you. If you do allow me, last night's discussion, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance of making a comment. I've only got a little paragraph to read, if you don't mind. Thank you. It is related to Gertrude Bell. On her way back to Baghdad from Paris, Miss Bell passed through Damascus, where she met Yasin Hashimi, who became Iraq's fourth prime minister. They were discussing the future education policy of Iraq. Miss Bell was aiming to establish a system not dissimilar to the UK, higher primary, secondary schools and universities. Yasin Hashimi argued that in 50 years' time, there would be engineers and other skills, but unfortunately there would not be enough educated politicians in Iraq to run the country. This was in 1919. Now add 50 years, according to Yasin Hashimi, now make it 1969. In 1969, I was here in London as a final year student of the university, and with many other thousands of Iraqis have studied and then gone back and participated in the building of modern Iraq. But, and this is the irony, a year before 1968, there was a coup in Iraq. And 10 years before that, there was a coup, 1958. And we all know what kind of politicians came from this coup. No. In a strange kind of way, both Miss Bell and Yasin Hashimi were right, but they both had a dream of creating a modern and prosperous Iraq. We must therefore embrace that dream for the good of the future of the country. Thank you.
And the genesis of sectarian division in modern Iraq. First of all, I'd like to thank everyone who participated in organizing this great conference. I think this conference is as much important for reassessing Iraqi history as it is for assessing and reading Bell's legacy. I'm writing my paper with one aim in mind, that is to critically assess modern Iraqi history. In the 10th anniversary of the American invasion of Iraq, Daniel Lauster wrote in The Independent that Bertolt Bell, who could draw the map of the post-colonial Iraqi state, was hoping to create a model for the entire Middle East, just as President George W. Bush had believed that USA-imposed democracy in Iraq would act as a model for the region at the dawn of the 21st century. End quote. Independent, 5th of March this year. The claim that Bill was obsessed with the noble hope of creating an Iraqi state, or democratic Iraqi state, that might be a good example to be imitated by other neighboring countries is astonishing and jarring. My argument here is that such a claim seems inconsistent with Bell's view, which did not claim to envision a democratic Iraq. However, this article, as we noticed yesterday, there was a claim that a tribal Iraqi people encountered the white burden, or mission in Iraq. Of course, this is nonsense. I think this article, in order to see the chaotic situation in modern Iraq through the prism of the past, what result of the American invasion of Iraq, some writers have argued, has been the conversion of the sectarian identities within Sunni and Shia in Iraq, communities in Iraq, and the Arab and Islamic world in general. Accordingly, sectarian division, including including in Iraq case, is portrayed as a new phenomenon brought about by the American invasion. This view, of course, tends to emphasize that Iraq is a new divided country dominated by the Shia majority who are trying to marginalize other Iraqi communities. Of course, my intention is not to go or to involve in sectarian rhetoric or practices, whether in Iraq or broader Arab and Islamic world. Instead, I intend to evaluate Bill's legacy in Iraqi politics by firstly reviewing the reaction of some Shia activists towards her role in establishing sectarian basis for the newly founded state, and secondly, reviewing briefly the unfolding of the relationship between British and Iraqi Shia, thirdly, illustrating Bill's view of the Shia and how this affected her role in Iraqi politics, and lastly, introducing a final assessment. First of all, let's talk about British Iraq and American Iraq, and who's Abu Naji and who's Abu Haydar. Most of you, I think, knows who's Abu Naji. Abu Naji is a design nickname used especially by Iraqi Shia to denote the British. The Iraqi Shia have been accustomed, and still until today, to use Abu Naji as a pejorative term for British officials who worked in Iraq during and after the British invasion of Iraq in the First World War. Ordinary Iraqis have developed the image of Abu Naji into a wicked, a creature, who is blamed for all the ills of the war. This is undoubtedly part of the conspiracy theory associated with the British, who are blamed for the detrimental situation that Iraqi Shia found themselves in after 1920. Whereas in the case of the American invasion, and George W. Bush in particular, the latter was known by the nickname Abu Haydar. Abu Haydar, as it is clear, is one of the most favorite Shia nicknames, which gives the impression that the Iraqi Shia were celebrating the determination shown by George W. Bush to get rid of Saddam Hussein. The end of Saddam regime signaled the end for the Sunni domination of Iraqi politics or state that lasted for around a century. Indeed, the second Iraqi state that was established in 2003 represent the stark contrary of the state that was formed in 1921. While Iraq of 1921 was designed solely by the British, Iraq of 2003 shaped almost by the American. Hassan Alawi actually argues that post-2003 is the opposite of the Iraq that established in 1921. He contends that the state of Iraq after 1920 was a British Iraq, and the one that designed after 2003 is an American Iraq. The British rule in creating the sectarian division in Iraq has been subject to harsh criticism from Iraqi Shia, who were affected most by this state. I'll mention here three examples. Kashf al-Ghatan, Hassan Alawi, and Shia Islamic Movement. Kashf al-Ghatan was the most active mujtahid in Shia world during the 1930s up until 1950s. He was depicted by the British as anti-British, anti-Zionist, and I can add he was anti-communist. He was in the recent memoirs, which published recently in Najaf, actually he gives, surprisingly, he gives the impression that he was against the 1920s revolution. That's because he was associated or under the influence of his master, Karl Malyezdi. And I will talk later about Karl Malyezdi and how the decision of Karl Malyezdi and ascent of Muhammad Taqi Shirazi changed not only the Marja'iyya, but only the caused a dramatic change in Iraqi history. However, Kashf al-Ghatan criticized the role played by the British and Bell in particular. He talked about the revolution. those who took up the rising succeeded with al-Shirazi but failed with al-Yazdi. Kashfullah accounts resembles to some extent that presented by Bell herself when she spoke of an increase in the nationalist propaganda. As I said, Kashfullah criticized the British rule, and he, when he was approached in 1950s, he was invited to a conference to confront the communist propaganda in Iraq. He said the disease of the communist disease in Iraq is because your politics in Iraq and in the whole Middle East and the French imperial rule in the East, actually it is the one we should blame for all the ills of Iraq. The other one, of course, is Hassan al-Alawi. Hassan al-Alawi is a nationalist, Arab nationalist writer. He first criticized the failure of the Sunni politician or nationalist in building a fair Iraqi state. He said they were directed by their personal and communal interests rather than the nation as a whole. And Alawi refers to the exceptional and critical role played by Bell in creating the new state after the 1920s. And of course, he criticized some Sunni politicians like Muzaffar al-Bajiji and others. The rules of the British, and Bell in particular, have been present within the literature of the Shia political movement since its inception in late 1950s. And I will not go into details about this. Actually, all this, for both Shia faithful and seculars, the Iraqi revolution of 1920s had come to usher in a new history that coincided with betrayal and anguish caused by Sunni elites holding the reins of power. That's the main theme that runs through all the literature announcement which published during the last, let's say, half a century or maybe more, might translate it into one message. Thus, the Iraqi Shia, the real defenders of Iraq, have lost power to a small Sunni group which tries to perpetuate its domination. This message became recurrent and more present during the next four decades. Let me talk now about the British and the Shia challenge. And we can summarize this in just three moments. In 1914, 1980s, 1920s. I chose this for some reason. In 1914s, as you know, Shia fighters joined the Ottomans to defend Iraq. After that, in 1918s, the second episode took place in 19th March 1918 when a group of armed Najafis killed Captain Marshall, one of the British Army political officers stationed in Najaf. This accident was planned by a secret society. Najafis endured the British siege for almost 2 months. The British forces attacked Najaf with cannons, and water and food supply was cut from the city. The city surrendered to the British, who captured rebels, executed 11 of them, and deported more than 100 of those involved in the uprising. Of course, the third episode, which is 1920s, was far-reaching. It is, as you know, it changed the whole course with the British, between the Shia and the British. Actually, the death of al-Yazdi, Muhammad Kadhim al-Yazdi, in April 1990s, opened the road not only for the ascent of Mirzataq al-Shirazi, as a sole marja for the Shia, but also for a dramatic change in contemporary Iraqi history. In fact, British officials attempted to build good relationship with al-Shirazi. However, these attempts were of no avail, as al-Shirazi espoused different position, and soon came under the influence of his son, Muhammad Rida, and the active Iraqi nationalist group. About Rabbi Elyushin, I think we can speak about two incidents which triggered the Rabbi Elyushin. That's the arrest of Muhammad Rida Shirazi on the arrest in June 1920s, followed by the detention of some Shia tribal chiefs, especially the supreme sheikh of Ghualim, Sha'lan Bichon. I think these two incidents brought both tribal chiefs and Shia mujtahidis to the belief that there will be no result from following a peaceful approach with the British. In March 1920, just 3 months before the revolution, Bertolt Brecht complained that, I quote, "It is a problem how to get into touch with the Shia. Both the tribal people in the country, we are in intimate terms with all of them, but the grimly default citizens of the holy towns, and more especially the leaders of religious opinion, the mujtahidis. However, Shia social and religious concerns were transformed now into concrete political claims and demand. When the revolution ended or quelled in October 1920s, the British sensed the difficulty involved in the business of setting a new Iraqi state. The importance of the Iraqi revolution, 1920s revolution, lies in modifying the direction of the British colonial policy in Iraq from direct into indirect rule. In this sense, it made the British more open to recruit more Iraqis into the administrating the new state. However, the main question put before the British colonial administration was, who are the people who should commission this task? Well, on the Shia issue. Certainly, that was the heart of Iraqi politics. As you know, she held very significant position as Oriental Secretary with Percy Coase and then with Sir Arnold Wilson. And this enabled her to influence and steer the direction of British policies since she was better acquainted with Iraqi figures and society. Bill, in fact, was reflecting her own personal judgment, which echoed the political situation in Iraq. For example, after visiting both Najaf and Karbala, she came to the conclusion that these areas at the end of January 1918 were generally quiet. Of course, she was wrong, because after 2 months, Captain Marshall was killed in Najaf. However, the confrontation between the Shia and the British added a new factor to that political situation. From then onward, Bell started to speak of no contact with the grimly default citizens of the Holy Towns. British officials were divided at this moment, were divided into two groups. The one who thought of controlling Iraqi state through Iraqis, and this view represented mainly by Bell, and those who argued for continuation of a British colonial administration, giving position to Iraqis to prepare them for the next stage. I can't say Bill of the first view and Wilson of the second view. And actually, Wilson was arguing that quote from Wilson, "The population is so deeply divided by racial and religious privileges, and the Shia majority after 200 years of Sunni domination are so little accustomed to hold high office that any attempt to introduce an institution in the line desired by the advanced Sunni politician of Syria would involve the concentration of power in the hands of few persons whose ambitions and method would rapidly bring about the collapse of organized government." Actually, that he was correct. However, Bell was coming to the view that Shia should not be allowed any chance to share the power, writing in the Shia in the new state. Writing again in 3rd of October 1920s, the Shia problem is probably the most formidable in this country. It is long quotation, however, I come to this. I don't, for a moment, doubt that the final authority must be in the hands of the Sunnis, in spite of their numerical inferiority. Otherwise, you will have a mujtahid-run theocratic state, which is the very devil. What is important to notice here, that her language, I mean her language, changed dramatically. Now she started to speak about the Shia leaders, the ulama, who were overlooking, I'm quoting from her, the fact that nearly all of their leaders, men, are Persian mujtahidis or subject, and must change their nationality before they can hold office in the Mesopotamian state. This statement, I can't say, has provided the basis and pretext for the later sectarian measure directed and executed by all successive Iraqi governments, starting from Abdel Nasser al-Sa'dun until Saddam regime, and we remember, of course, his campaigns against the Shia Faili, against the Kerr, against Marsh Arab, all actually executed under the name of the who is a true Iraqi, who is not. And used especially against the Shia and the Kurd. However, Ben was indeniably not alone in her position against the Shia. If you would like, just read Thomas Lee, The Ins and Outs of Mesopotamia. This is very interesting. Actually, he argues in his introduction, he wants to show that the Muslims, and particularly the Shia, is and for many years must remain totally unfit for self-government. Of course, a few observers notice this hypocrisy with the bill, we could say. Abdullah Nafisi, who became one of the most aggressive critics against the Shia after 2003, he provided in his book, he admitted that Bell provided was, she had the first experience, in Iraq. But she failed to understand the mentality of Shia ulama, for example. Nasser, Wali Nasser, accuses Bell of romanticism. He said that the Shia and their religious leader did not fit Bell's romantic view of the Arabs. Then, if I could conclude this in 3 points. First, there appeared a negative attitude among the British colonial officials toward the Shia ulama. And we spoke about this. There was the change in the Shia marja'iyya from one who, let's say, was friendly with them, Karim al-Yazdi, to Muhammad Taqi Shirazi. And the second was that during and after 1920s revolution, there was the immense serious tension between two broad camps, the Shia camp represented mainly by Haras al-Istiqlal, the Guardians of Independence, and Al-Ahd, which composed solely of Sunni personnel. The first camp was calling for nothing short of the full withdrawal of the British, and the other was calling for a more cooperative approach. The third, of course, most important, is the mass population of the Shia mujtahidis, who showed great sympathy towards the cause of the Ottoman. They continue with their miscalculation after the 1920s. However, the Sunni attitude left a stamp in the future thinking of a Shia as they felt deep hurt by Sunni pragmatism. This actually reflected after 2003. The attitude of the Shia ulama after 2003 reflected and recalled more their historical memory and say already treat miscalculation, and this explains their realistic and we could say even their towards the new invaders. No doubt, Sayyid Sistani and other leading ulama learned the experience of the past. This explains, no doubt, many of the tragedies that are happening in Iraq today. Indeed, Gottwald Bill was present at the very moment of creating the new Iraqi state in the 1920s, and her ghost still seems to haunt its birth after 2003. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm delighted that none of our three speakers have decided to shy away from controversy. And I was pleased to see heads shaking and heads nodding in roughly equal measure as each of the three of them spoke. I would expect a lively discussion to happen, but for the sake of convenience, it'd be good if we could get people in groups of, say, three asking questions or putting points in sequence. Please do try to keep comments short. Furthermore, it'd be good if you could just quickly tell us who you are before you start, before you give your question or make your comment. Just your name and your institutional affiliation would be helpful. So could we begin?
Nadia Ali Soas. Yeah, thanks. This was a fascinating panel. I have two questions. One is, I was wondering, Toby mainly, but also Dr. Kadhim, if you think about the prevailing discourse at the time, and you just mentioned Oriental despotism, can we have a little bit more sort of layers what that actually entails, and in how far is Gertrude Bell representative, and in how far does she actually challenge it? I mean, because from what we've been hearing since yesterday, this is a person full of contradictions, and she is as much implicated as also ambiguous, partly because of her gender, but maybe also because of other reasons, her politics. So I'd like to know more about the actual substance of Oriental despotism. So, for instance, you know, the reifying of tribal and sectarian identities, and it's not just the reifying, but it's actually the favoring of one over the other. And then leading to that, and also building on yesterday's discussion, if we accept that Gertrude Bell was not only part of the process of reifying tribal and sectarian identities, but also of favoring one sectarian identity over the other, what then do we say about 2003 in terms of the reifying of tribal and sectarian identities, and I would say the favoring of one sectarian group over the other? What is that relationship?
Okay. We have another question here. Would you?
I have a question for two panelists. My name is Tamara Chalabi. The first panelist, I was just interested in his opinion. In the event of the Arab Bureau's project having failed, how would you have envisaged an Indian administration in Iraq? I mean, the A.T. Wilson view. And with regards to the last panelist, I just wanted to draw attention to the fact he, in 1914, there was general enforced conscription all over the Ottoman Empire, including in Iraq. It was called the Safar Barlik. There's a lot of literature about it. So the Shia of Iraq did not voluntarily go out and fight against the Ottoman Empire. Furthermore, two things developed from that. One is that the men who were conscripted from Iraq were actually sent off to fight in the Caucasus against Russia. They did not fight in Iraq themselves. Secondly, a lot of Shia families at the time, in order to avoid the conscription, took Persian papers because of the ambiguous identity, I mean not identity, but in terms of their Shia connections to Iran and the holy cities. This is one point. The other point I wanted to make is just going, having gone through the British archives, you talk about the Al-Ahd and the Haras al-Istiqlal. The period between late 1919 and mid-1920, when the revolt, broke out, you have excessive meetings and collaboration between Sunnis and Shia, particularly notables in Baghdad, which resulted in lots of different communiques, decisions, etc. And they took place in both in Baghdad, in actually also symbolically in the Gilani Mosque, in Kazmiya, in various places. So to assume that there was no communication at all, I think, I mean, I would disagree with that. And my final point, absolutely, is that, you know, Shirazi, as an Ayatollah, as a Marja, actually made it, put out a fatwa forbidding all Shia from participating in the Iraqi, the new Iraqi government, the British mandate, which had much wider repercussions than just Iraq. It affected a lot of Arab Shia, namely in Lebanon and Syria as well. So how do you explain that? Thank you.
Let's take Rosemary. Would you like to next?
Thank you. Rosemary Hollis from City University. I have a very specific question for Toby, please. Having enjoyed thoroughly your splendid presentation, I wondered if you thought it essential to explain the British narrative about Iraq in terms of their own fears about social change in the UK, which you mentioned. Wouldn't it be sufficient for them simply to have a narrative that justified why Iraq needed their attention? Why does it have to project their fears as well?
Okay, we have six questions here. Maybe taking them in one go wasn't such a good idea after all. But let's try and see what the panelists would like to make of these. We have questions on Oriental despotism, on the reification of sectarian identities, on the potential Indianization of the administration, on Shia ambiguous relationship to the Ottoman military, cooperation and communication across seeming sectarian divides, and on the nature of British projection of their fears. Toby.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Is that not awesome? Just to first a point of departure to kind of put my working method on the table, and my working method has evolved after many years of prodding British imperialism in Iraq and then prodding whatever we call the Americans after 2003. And the point of departure would be, you think Gertrude Bell, Paul Bremer, David Petraeus, whoever it is, you drop them in a country about which they know very little, and they're confronted with a tidal wave of empirical data. And of course, then you go to cognitive social science and you clearly identify that they need simple frames of reference to understand that data, as we all do. But as social scientists, we expose our simple frames of reference, and policymakers and civil servants not only don't expose them, they don't need to, they probably apply them subconsciously, not consciously. So what we're trying to do is take the lid off how key policymakers are processing information. That's the simple thing, straightforward. Then we go to Bell and her contemporaries. I don't see Bell in any way as exceptional. I was very much on your presentation, I was thinking of my own work on Bell, and clearly the denigration of the Mujtahid is continually compared to Catholicism, the structure of the Catholic Church and the Pope. So once again, to go to Rosemary's point, she's lifting a very straightforward and easily detectable fear within British society. You can still stumble across it embarrassingly frequently, and using it to understand the problems in Iraq. So there's that. So I don't find Bell in any way a figure of contradiction. I find her in that case to be a quite straightforward member of the upper middle classes in Britain, applying similar units of analysis to anyone else. We then come through to 2003, and of course, until end of 2006-07, tribal reification was the dog that didn't bark, as it were. So dreadfully mix my metaphors in that sense, but that you have quite amusingly, and Glenn's written about this, the long-lost descendant of Sheikh Ali Ali Suleiman of the Dulaim, and the Marines find him, I think, 2004, and they go, this guy's going to give us a passive anbar. All we need to do is give him Pepsi Cola and jobs. And of course, he has no power whatsoever, as his great-great-grandfather did in anbar in 1920. So that dropped away. But again, I was listening to the last presentation and thinking, the
deliberate demonization, reification, and exclusion of a section of society that becomes the other in post-2003 Iraq. We call it Baathism, but certainly Bremer and Anne Wolfowitz expanded that category to taint, if not to envelop, a larger community. They claimed Baathism came from the Sunni section of society. Was a way of making simple the complexity of the task they'd set themselves, and making simple the structures of Iraqi society. Now, to ask Adam's question, I was struggling to dig out of my addled mind the comparison. Now, what's quite fat is a brilliant question, which I'm not qualified to answer, but I'll have a stab at it. An Indian administration clearly would, as A.T. Wilson wanted, have locked down the country in not even a quasar. There would, the justification for the mandates, the shallow justification for the mandates, you had quite a simple exercise in imperial rule. Now, what stops that, and I think was touched upon in it, is firstly Woodrow Wilson basically saying, we haven't fought this war simply for especially what became Yugoslavia, but also the areas of the Ottoman Empire simply to be divided up. So Wilson, I think, is a major figure in 1920 at the peace conferences, banging the table and demanding that all isn't reproduced, but also nationalist opinion across the British Empire, but especially on the ground in Baghdad and in Damascus. There was a mobilization of intelligent, what would you call it, educated middle class opinion, saying you can't do this. Now, the British damned it as being a minority of self-seeking offenders and lawyers, but it was a mobilization. You see the recent historical scholarship on the people that lobbied Wilson in the rounds in the aftermath of the Paris Peace Conference. You do have the role of nationalism. What's more interesting, at least for me, and I'm on safer ground, is the debate within the British administration about how we run Iraq. Do we run it like the Punjab, or do we run it like the Northwest Frontier? And ironically, because Dobbs and Humphreys did their time on the Northwest Frontier, and their image of a tribal society, unindividuated, untouched by modernity, chimed with a wider colonial civil service. It was the Northwest Frontier that won out. Now, on Rose's point, I suppose my base argument is, and it would apply to the American occupation of Iraq from 2003 or the British occupation from 1920, it's not necessarily fear, it's how we understand social complexity. Both missions were either imperial or quasi-imperial. This state doesn't work, we're going to take it on ourselves as outsiders to rebuild it in a better fashion. And so how are we going to, what is good? How do we save the Iraqis from themselves? Oh, we build a state like the one we have, and bless Paul Bremer, the only benefit I give him is he's transparent both in his imperial mission, and you privatize, you break the power of the state, you are on a neoliberal mission to turn Iraq into America, and when it failed, it's of course not our fault. It's these Iraqis, they're irrational, they don't want freedom anymore, or they're religious, or there's outsiders. Blair's extended justification for screwing up and sacrificing the lives of tens of thousands of Iraqis is, it wasn't my fault, Gov. It was those naughty people who came across the border after we did well. Don't blame me, my instincts were good. So in a way, I think it's unavoidable to use the perception of your own society and the model, especially as both Blair, Bremer, Bell and Cox and Humphreys and Dobbs are on a quasi-imperial mission to transform Iraq to look like us, whoever we are.
My head would just come.
Oh dear. That is really embarrassing. Sorry. You know, if you ask any Iraqi now what was the best day in Iraq and the history of Iraq, they would all say 13th July 1958, that's the day before the 14th of July revolution. Now, yes, Iraq wasn't perfect, yeah, but it was working. And I can't understand up to now, really, how much has been done to blow up the sectarian question. I came on a scholarship in 1964. Half of the plane, maybe three quarters of it, were Shiite people. So there was no discrimination. Maybe, of course, a lot of people would say, yes, there was. Nobody was in government. But assuming there was 60 to 65% of the Iraqis are Shiites anyway. Now, most of the... I worked in the government, I worked in Iraq, I worked in offices. Now, 65% of these people working were Shiites. 65% were in the army, 65% were everywhere. And I really find it very, very difficult up to this minute to understand or to argue about what's called a sectarian divide, whether the British favoured this section or they didn't favour another sect. And I honestly believe that if they have left it as it was, as Gertrude Bella said it, and then the British run it, and we, you know, with all the various governments that came after the coronation until 1958, maybe things would have been better. But, and this is where the problem is, I mean, that would be between 21 and 58, that would be about, what, so 40 years. Do we have to wait for another 40 years and have another conference to find out whether what's happening now has worked or not? I hope not. So let's look at the bright side and hope for the best.
Would you like to come in on Bell's ghost?
Yeah. I mean, whether Bell was favouring some section, definitely, there's no doubt about it. No need to go in details about this. If you go to her diaries, to the books, you feel the sense that she cannot hide her hatred against the Shia, you know, because they rebelled against us, then we should punish them and to give the authority for the Sunnis. There's no doubt about it. After 2003, whether the sectarian, you know, dimension or let's say element encouraged by the American, of course, the American, you know, encourage this element by somehow. But when it comes to, let's say, when compared with 1920s, who brought the Iraqi government? There was no Shia minister there. But after 2003, who excluded the Sunnis? It was Al-Qaeda. Most of the people who targeted the Sunni actually was from Al-Qaeda. And of course, I agree, there was like an element, there was exclusion for the Sunni. But to compare it, don't forget the regional context. We should not undermine the regional, I mean, the Saudi Arabia, the Turkey, Jordan. Now the political situation is completely different from 1920s. I mean, we should bear in mind the regional context. About Hasil Istiqlal and Al-Ahd, well, of course there was communication and contact between them, but when it comes to the first Iraqi, you know, government, this was the trick. I mean, when you read Bell, she was saying that we should favor the less radical people from Al-Ahd rather than Al-Istiqlal. Because Hamas and Istiqlal were calling for the nothing rather than, you know, the full withdrawal of the British forces. And Al-Ahd was calling for some a pragmatic attitude. Well, that's why Al-Ahd was favored by the British. About the Fatwa Shirazi against the British, I mean, Al-Shirazi actually prohibited Muslims and, of course, let's say, Shia from participating or, let's say, obey this government. It was about the election of, let's say, after 1923. This order this religious order, I think, is, you are talking about different one, which was issued by Naini al-Khalisi, but not by al-Shirazi. Al-Shirazi, I'm talking about 1920 or 1919. We have different two orders.
Let's take another very quick round of questions. Eleanor was first up.
Thanks, Owen. Thank you all for your fascinating papers. I have a quick question for Toby. Could you tell us a little bit more about how those books that you talked about were received back here in Britain, print runs, newspaper reviews, that sort of things, and the sort of public discussion they engendered?
Ali.
Ali Alawi from the National University. I find the panel's discussions extremely interesting, but they also seem to be reflective of what I would call a day fix. There doesn't seem to be much change in the way the argument is structured since the 1920s. We have the, on one side, the terrible face of imperial policy and the exploitation of native peoples by a distant power. We have the, well, Hafez was the most moderate, I think, the kind of moderate Arab nationalist perspective as to what has happened since the mandate system was introduced. And Dr. Fuad Kavim, which is very much, I would call it, the Shia narrative of how things have evolved in Iraq. Why I find it curious is that, and I don't want to take up too much time, is that there are other parties to this game. And here I'm speaking specifically of Faisal, who did not run, who was king of the country, and he wasn't there just for decorative purposes. The British wanted him as the cat's paw, the way in which they were going to exercise indirect rule. But there's no doubt in my mind that he fought tooth and nail not to be fitted into that category. The Shias, by and large, I say, not all of them, because he had many Shia supporters and collaborators in the government. In fact, the Mujtahids of Najaf sent his father a request way before the 1920 rebellion to send one of his sons to rule over Iraq. The Shias had with him several collaborators, including Sayyid Muhammad al-Sadr, who was an Ayatollah and was one of the main opponents of the British in 1920s, and switched. And other politicians, Jafar Abutiman was not necessarily opposed to him. He was for independence. So there was an element of collaboration there. And throughout his period of his rule, he kept on trying to increase the percentage and the proportion of Shias in the government. And if you look at all the scholarships that were awarded in the 1920s, there was very, very little sectarian or even religious discrimination between them. The first group of scholarship students were mainly Christians and Jews. So there's this other side to the story that we have not heard, and I think it's really critical to include it if you're going to situate Bell and her significance and importance. There is the role of the Iraqi political class at whose apex stood a king.
Okay. I'm afraid we are running out of time, so please, just a very quick, any quick last questions, especially from somebody who hasn't been presenting already so far in this conference. So, sir, please.
Thank you. Just a very quick question about, I think we can all agree that the dropping of phosphor bombs in the 20s on villages was an atrocity, what we now call a war crime. And to some extent we can also agree that Gertrude Bell was implicated, I think that was the word you used. But how implicated was she? Did she ever express an opinion or condemn it or approve of it? Or?
With apologies to our two Iraqi speakers, both questions were primarily directed at Toby. Could I ask Toby just to give quick responses to those two?
I think the benefit of an event like this is to tease out the tensions, both explored and unexplored, in the historiography of Iraq. So if we take Faisal's role in Iraq after the 20s on, clearly, and detailed in great depth in my work, is the way that the mandate and the shift and
close to bankruptcy of the British state meant that power was shifted very quickly, much more quickly than colonial officials had hoped, from the colonial civil servants to the Iraqi elite that they'd picked and who gained much greater autonomy and then went on to run the state. So that's certainly the case. Second, so that's the historiography of the 1920s. The history of the 1960s is quite amusing because there's clearly undoubtedly an affection, especially for those people who lived it and then went into exile after 58, for the monarchical regime 32 to 58. But that would then say that somehow the coup in 58 and the massive popular demonstrations that greeted it in Baghdad somehow dropped out of a blue sky, and these army officers were somehow unconnected to a wider set of social forces, the massive slums around Baghdad, the weak state that didn't build any infrastructure, the inequality of wealth between those who'd been favoured by the regime and had accrued wealth directly as the favour of the regime, and the mass majority of Iraqis who hadn't. So 58 didn't come out of a blue sky. It was delivered directly by the failures of the state created by the British. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay, I'll have to leave, I'm afraid, Ellen, as the final question for Toby to answer in confidence later with questioners. Just three final notices. First, the good news for all of those of you who had hands up at the end is that we'll be continuing this discussion of the foundation of the Iraqi state in this afternoon session, so your questions will not go unanswered, I hope, at that stage. My second notice, even better, is that we have lunch now, which is... Let me move quickly on to my third notice then, which is just to thank the three speakers that we have, the three panellists we've had, all of whom have given very well-researched and very intelligent presentations, and I do hope that we've all learned something from each of them. Thank you very much.